Court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I will call our third case for the day, State v. Hendricks. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
May I begin?
Yes.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Hannah Sheber Durst, and it is my privilege to be here today on behalf of Mr. Shannon Hendricks. I am going to focus my argument on three main points. First, at its core, this case concerns what a defendant must understand about the offense to enter a knowing plea. Second, as the Court of Appeals now recognizes, its rationale in Steele is flawed, and this Court should overrule it. Third, all we seek is the application of already existing law to grant the evidentiary hearing which the State agreed, post-conviction, Mr. Hendricks was entitled to have. First, at its core, this case concerns what a defendant must understand to enter a knowing plea. In Bangert and in cases since, including Bolig, this Court has explained that if a defendant does not have a full understanding about the nature of the offense to which he pleads guilty, his plea violates due process. Importantly, therefore, at a plea hearing, a circuit court must do more than assure itself that the defendant is guilty. Among other things, it has to ensure that the defendant understands the nature of the offense, the legal nature of the offense. And this is critical because when a defendant pleads guilty, he gives up his fundamental constitutional trial rights.
Counsel, I'd like to understand a little bit better the Steele methodology in determining what are the essential elements. My understanding is that when a crime follows the pattern of act plus intent to commit one of a list of other acts, that the jury does not need to be unanimous on which of those, which in the list of alternatives the defendant intended to commit. Is that right so far?
It depends on what statute is at play and the alternatives there. And so that's that jury unanimity question. There may be situations where if a statute provides alternative modes for commission of a single offense, a jury would need to unanimously agree on which of the alternative modes, would need to unanimously agree on the alternative modes. And the question there for unanimity purposes is whether the alternative modes are conceptually similar or not.
Mm-hmm.
So really it depends.
All right. So have we decided yet whether the list of alternative potential intents that the defendant had in a child enticement charge are modes of commission?
Yes, this Court has in Durango. So okay. For purposes of child enticement, that's been established.
All right. So under the Steele methodology, then, that says that the jury does not need to be unanimous with respect to which one of those six alternatives he intended to commit, correct?
Right.
But does the jury need to be unanimous? They did intend to do something on that list.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now tell me, how does that piece translate into the plea colloquy context? Mm-hmm. How do we handle the part of the jury unanimity that requires the defendant intended to do something on that list? How is that handled?
So the way this Court handles it is by recognizing that the jury unanimity question has no bearing on what a defendant needs to understand to enter a knowing plea.
So we say that, under Steele, that since he only needs to intend something on that list, we don't need to address that at all during the plea colloquy. Is that right?
No. That's the opposite of what we're saying.
I know it's the opposite of what you're saying. I want to make sure I understand the groundwork here first. So right now, because you're asking to overrule Steele.
Right.
Okay. So under the Steele methodology, okay, currently, the court looks at this and says, well, the jury does not need to be unanimous about which of the alternatives he intended to commit.
Right.
So we just don't need to look at that at all,
right,
for plea colloquy purposes.
Yes. Under,
okay,
Steele, it would be sufficient for a circuit court to explain, this statute requires that you caused a child to go to a secluded place with intent to do blank. That's all that would be required under Steele. And the problem is the blank is what makes that a crime. And so that's why jury unanimity case law and what's required under Bangert are completely apples and oranges. Because to say that a defendant in that situation doesn't need to understand the intention is elevating form over substance, because of course he needs to know what it is that we're saying he intended on doing to enter a knowing plea.
Now, if this were a jury trial instead of a guilty plea, the jury would be instructed that the elements are that the defendant caused the victim to go into a building or secluded place. The defendant caused the victim to go into the secluded place with intent to. I'm looking at the jury instructions, and then footnote 5 says, here, identify the conduct specified in 1 to 6 of 94807. Care should be taken to provide a complete description of what the conduct requires, including definition of terms where necessary. The committee suggests the following. This is under 94802. Have sexual conduct with the name of the victim. Sexual contact is the intentional touching by the defendant of an intimate part of another done for the purpose of sexual arousal or gratification, sexually degrading or humiliating that person. So if the jury was instructed, they would be told they have to find the conduct was for the purpose or the intent of sexual conduct, and sexual conduct would be defined for the jury. You want that to be defined for the defendant, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would have been satisfied if they had followed the jury instruction?
Absolutely.
And that works for this case where you have six ways of committing this offense. But what about burglary, where you have a large number of potential felonies that could have been intended in the burglary? What do you want done then?
Well, in that situation, if the court followed the pattern jury instructions for burglary with intent to commit a felony, which I have that instruction, I believe it's 1424,
mm-hmm,
that jury instruction tells the court to instruct the jury that of the elements of burglary with intent to commit a felony, so the defendant entered, let's say, a residence without consent with intent to commit a felony, and then the instructions explicitly advise the court to explain to the jury the elements of the felony that's alleged. So that again shows why Steele is problematic, because the jury instructions in both situations tell us that a jury to convict the defendant must have that understanding.
Well, the charge might have been for sexual contact, but if we're having a trial, then there may have been proof admitted that there was another intent,
mm-hmm,
there, right? Then what do you do with the jury?
Then, if the court's following the jury instructions, it would give the definitions for the particular alternative modes that are alleged, right? So if it's sexual contact or sexual intercourse, the instructions inform the court to advise the jury of those alternatives. But in that situation, a court would not have to, for example, also explain that sexual contact can be to try and sell the juvenile drugs. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's, in effect, you want the judge to give, in the plea colloquy, something like the judge would give the jury as instructions.
In this case, yes, and that's because this court has explained in Bolig and the Court of Appeals explained in Gibson and Nicholson that the term sexual contact has a particular legal definition that requires that explanation.
But if it didn't, then you'd expect him to just use general information or general knowledge of what sexual contact is.
If I think it's a different question if this court and the Court of Appeals decisions in Gibson and Nicholson hadn't already explained that sexual contact requires that explanation.
What if the court should hold your way, what effect would that have about all the cases that have already been decided?
Which the...
That follows Steele.
There have been no appellate cases in Wisconsin, to my knowledge, Court of Appeals decisions or decisions from this court, other than this case, that have even cited to Steele, let alone applied that rationale. And I think that shows that this is an outlier tremendously.
Do you have any cases that you have found, either in that the public defender has found at the trial court level, where the judge does do what you want him to do or her to do?
I haven't specifically researched that question, but I expect that there would be, since this court in Bangard and in the cases since have directed courts to look at the jury instruction when they're advising a defendant.
I have another question. At the, in order to qualify for a Mockner hearing, does the trial court look only to the colloquy or the whole record to see if the defendant has understood the nature of the offense?
And so just to be clear, Your Honor said Mockner hearing. What we're asking for is a Bangard hearing?
Bangard, I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's an evidentiary hearing,
right.
Whatever you call it. Thank
Absolutely.
You, but I am corrected.
So this court in the Hampton decision explained that when we're looking at whether or not we've met our prima facie burden, the focus is on the plea. But then at the evidentiary hearing, which again is all we're asking for in this case, the state will have the opportunity, looking at the entire record, as well as whatever testimony is elicited, to try and meet its burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Hendricks nevertheless, in fact, understood the meaning of sexual contact.
Now, as I understand Bangard, that was an interpretation of our statute relating to pleas and
right.
what has to be done, right?
Yes.
And the state is asking us to amend the Bangard hearing, a Bangard decision, to follow more recent U.S. Supreme Court cases that would indicate, according to the state, that the trial judge does not have to advise the defendant, as you say.
Right. I think that's extremely problematic for a few reasons. The first reason, and probably the most important, is that it has no bearing on this case. If anything, this case is a demonstration of why that would be problematic. And that's because if all we had here was defense counsel saying, yes, I explained the elements to him, we see, based on the jury instructions attached to the plea colloquy, that that did not include an explanation of the definition of sexual contact. It didn't even specify which intention Mr. Hendricks was allegedly supposed to have had. The jury instructions attached to the plea questionnaire form say, you caused a child to go to a secluded place with intent to do blank. And it was only after the circuit court, and we commend the circuit court for this, recognizing that Mr. Hendricks had to plead guilty to one of those six subsections of child enticement, that then the court had a sidebar with the attorneys, and they picked sexual contact. So this case demonstrates why that's why removing the requirement from Bangard that a defense attorney then summarize the elements, if that's what the court is using to satisfy Bangert would be problematic.
So here the trial court looked at the testimony from the prelim.
Yes.
And it was the victim who testified about what he did and said and what she did and said. And in his plea, he admitted that that testimony was correct, right?
He admitted that he did what she testified to at the preliminary hearing,
okay.
Yes.
And is sexual contact, that term, a legal term or is that a factual term?
It's a legal term, Your Honor.
Okay. So if he admits to the facts that comprise sexual contact, mm-hmm. why do we have to be concerned if he didn't know the definition, the legal definition of sexual contact?
That's because the requirement of the court establishing a factual basis, meaning that the facts do in fact amount to sexual contact, and the requirement that a defendant understand the nature of the offense, the legal nature of that offense, are two entirely separate responsibilities of the circuit court.
Well, I don't doubt they're separate responsibilities, but when he admitted mm-hmm. that everything that was said at the prelim was correct, I guess I find a little disconnect between his admitting sexual contact factually with his lack of understanding of the legal term sexual contact, and why should we be bothered about that difference?
So, 2 points in response to that. To say that that's not a bother would be to effectively overrule Bangert. And the reason I say that is because in Bangert, this court explained that a defendant's understanding of the nature of the offense must include an accurate knowledge of the essential elements of the offense and an understanding of those accurate definition. And the reason why that has to be the case is because the U.S. Supreme Court explained in Boykin that there must be affirmative showing of that knowledge of the legal those legal elements. A second response to Your Honor's question is the reality of the matter is a defendant who is absolutely unquestionably guilty, right? We can all look at it and say absolutely this defendant is guilty, still is entitled to a trial. And so it's important that he understands when he gives up his right to a trial what it is legally that he's acknowledging doing and what it is that the state would have to prove but for that plea.
But, counsel, if I buy your argument, I could put that on to a lot of legal conclusions that are in the criminal code, and we'd have to make every defendant a knowledgeable criminal lawyer to understand the legal concept when really what he would be convicted of is just the facts that under legal terminology support the concept.
So perhaps another example, in Boykin, the U.S. Supreme Court analogized this to a defendant's waiver of counsel at a trial. And I think saying, well, he admitted the facts, therefore that's enough for us, would be akin to saying that a defendant who had an attorney at some point and then waived that right to an attorney at trial, we could say, well, he obviously knew he could have an attorney, so why do we need to go in and do a colloquy? Well, because we need to do a colloquy because of the ramifications that come from that, and because we know the legal standards, but that doesn't mean that he does. And for a plea to be constitutional, we have to have proof in the record that he understands what those legal standards are so he can make an informed decision about whether or not he wants to enter a guilty plea.
Counsel, let's try it this way. You would acknowledge that the facts to which he conceded constitute sexual contact.
Yes.
Okay. So is your position then that all that was lacking is for the court to then say, and by the way, Mr. Hendricks, that's sexual contact?
Even that would not be enough under Bangert.
Why not?
Because this court explained in Bangert that a defendant's mere perfunctory, yes, I understand this was fear sexual contact, is not going to be enough to ensure that he both had an accurate understanding of what that is, of that legal definition, and actually did, in fact, understand what that definition is.
But if the court informs him that the act to which he just admitted constitutes sexual contact by law, what else does he need to know?
Well, I recognize that would be a closer call, but I still think the law stresses that he has to have, this court said in Bangert, that understanding has knowledge as its antecedent. And so we can't affirmatively know that he understood the meaning of sexual contact if that's never been given to him.
So is it, okay, I'm trying to find out where the line is that divides what was done and what was necessary. Now, his attorney said in front of Mr. Hendricks and in open court, by the judge, mm-hmm. the contact he intended to have is as described as the victim. And the victim described sexual contact. So are you saying that in order for this to be sufficient, the court would have to give him the statutory definition of sexual contact so that he can then line up the facts that he's admitted to that statute? Is that what you're saying?
He has to have been given and understand the legal definition of that offense. The court doesn't have to line that up with the facts.
Well,
but
Who does?
Under Trochinsky, this court explained that there isn't any requirement that the defendant be aware of how the legal definition apply to the facts. We have two separate requirements. We have ensuring that a defendant understands the legal nature of the offense, and then we have the court making sure that that meets the facts meet the statutory definition.
Right. So why can't that be combined into a single admission? Right. So now, going back, counsel says the contact to which we're pleading mm-hmm. is as described as by the victim. So now, Mr. Hendricks, if he's listening closely, he knows there's an intent to do an act element here, mm-hmm. right? And my attorney just said the contact that the victim testified, and that I'm admitting to that. Why is that not both an exposition of the facts and a description of what is prohibited?
I think, while I agree that's a much better colloquy, I think the problem still is that we are guessing at what his understanding was. So if we look at either Gibson or Nicholson, in both of those cases, in the Gibson case, for example, at the plea hearing, at the post-conviction hearing, the defendant acknowledged that his touching of the girl that there would be no other reason for it other than his own sexual gratification. And the Court of Appeals said that's still not enough because it doesn't communicate the fact that, or it doesn't show us that he understood that the purpose of his action, so for his gratification, was something that the state would have to prove. And so I think if we take this same case and we have the court say, are you agreeing you touched her intentionally? Yes. And you're agreeing that it was for purpose of your sexual gratification? Yes. And you understand that the state would have to prove that it was intentionally done and for purposes of your gratification if you went to trial on this charge? Yes. We have a sufficient colloquy. The only thing we request is the evidentiary hearing to which the state agreed post-conviction Mr. Hendricks was entitled to have. We're not asking for any dramatic expansion of the law. We're asking for the only reasonable application of the Bolig, Gibson, and Nicholson line of cases to this offense, because there is no reasonable way, when due process focuses on the defendant's understanding, for us to say that on the one hand, a defendant who pleads guilty to actually having sexual contact must understand that legal definition to enter a knowing plea, but to say that a defendant who intends to do that same thing need not. It's the state that's asking for something dramatic, and that's for this court to, for the first time, impose a jury unanimity analysis into the Bangert framework. This would impose more onerous requirements on circuit courts. Now a court to decide whether it needs to explain something to a defendant under Bangert would have to perform a jury unanimity analysis, which is a complicated constitutional analysis, instead of just asking what is necessary under the law for the defendant to enter a knowing plea and understand the legal nature of the offense.
I thought the state is only asking that we repair Bangert to say that if the defense counsel says that he or she told the right things to the defendant, that's good enough, and that the defense counsel needn't give a summary of what the defense counsel said, which is what Bangert said he had to do.
So I see my time has expired. May I?
But you can answer the question.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
No, at least as I see it, the states are asking this court to adopt the analysis of Steele, which reduces the banger question to a question of jury unanimity. And then independently, but not even connected to this case, the state is asking this court to do what Your Honor instructed.
But
thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, and I represent the state. The nature, the statute, and the Constitution both require that the defendant who pleads guilty understands the nature of the offense, or the nature of the crime, or the nature of the charge. All the same thing. That has traditionally been defined as the elements of the offense. The reason that unanimity cases are important in that analysis is not because of the underlying analysis for unanimity cases, but because in doing that analysis, the court must determine what are the elements of an offense. Because a unanimity case asks, has the legislature created one crime with multiple modes of commission, or has it created a number of crimes, each which has separate elements? So the court focuses on what were the elements that the legislature set out for this particular crime. What Durango does is it sets out the elements for child enticement. And that's the only bearing it has on this plea colloquy. Because we look at Durango, we know exactly what the elements of the offense are, of that offense is, are, sorry. And we know that those intents, which includes the sexual contact, are not elements.
Counsel, isn't this all much ado about nothing? Look, the defendant admitted to the offense by admitting the facts underlying the offense, so isn't that enough?
I think it is, and I think
what about when you started out, the Constitution requires the defendant understand the elements of the offense. Isn't that a constitutional process that's mandated?
Well, but the Constitution also requires that the defendant admit to facts that constitute a factual basis for the offense.
Okay.
We divide them into separate analysis because they're under different subsections
That's
of the
right.
statute.
That's right. They're under different subsections. Both are constitutionally mandated. And
right.
I
guess I'm hung up on rules today. Just seems to me, just because defendants are guilty, and let me say as a sidebar, you fill it in, the percentage of defendants are guilty of something, and you put in that percentage. Our inquiry here today and the circuit court's inquiry isn't merely whether the defendant is guilty. There is a process. There are rules. We're talking about the rule of law, right? And the process, the constitutional requirements, he understands the elements of the offense. That's what we do as an institution. Regardless if he's guilty, that's his guilt is virtually irrelevant when you look at the question of whether or not a judge performs the constitutional requirement of making sure the defendant understands the elements or the nature of the defense. Who cares if he's guilty or she's guilty? That doesn't come into the analysis, does it, or am I missing something?
I would disagree with you.
Okay, I'm missing something. Tell me why you think
I think that's the whole question, frankly. We don't want someone who's not guilty of the crime pleading guilty to it.
I guess
that's
It's where you start. First of all, there's a constitutional responsibility. There's a responsibility under the Constitution to make sure the defendant knows and understands the nature of the offense. And I would posit that threshold question is regardless of whether or not the defendant is guilty. The next question may go into factual basis.
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with you on that, because why do we ask that the defendant understand the elements of the offense? It's so that the defendant can assure himself or herself that she's actually guilty, isn't it? I think it is.
Well, I think that, I mean, I see it as a, I don't know if I would use hierarchy, but separate and distinct constitutional requirements that ultimately come to the question of whether the defendant knowing and intelligently and voluntarily entered a plea. But there are threshold constitutional procedures that we follow in order to reach that conclusion.
Well, I guess I see the elements as a way to make sure that that a defendant understands that they're in fact guilty.
Well, let's go back to the charge, if we can. Are you done answering that question? I don't want to interrupt you.
I'm finished.
Okay. So, could the state charge here that the defendant committed a violation of the statute? And said that with the intent of violating one of the six or several of the six categories, or does the complaint have to state what the state's charge is and which one is being violated?
I don't think it would have to state one or more.
Okay.
I don't think it has to limit itself to one.
No, I agree, but it has to state something other than all six of the statute.
Well, I don't know. I think it could state all six of the statute.
Okay, does it have to state any fact?
As long as there's some factual support for all six.
Okay, so it has to have in its complaint some factual support for any or all of the six, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Can't just say with the intent to commit one of these.
And, right.
Okay. So we say for purposes of Steele that one of these six or all six are not elements, right, of the crime.
Well, yes.
For purposes of jury unanimity, right?
Right.
But for purposes of instructing the jury is told that the alternative that the state selects is an element that they have to agree to.
Well, but the state doesn't have to select one.
No,
it doesn't have to select one at trial. Why should it have to select one at the plea?
But it has to prove it by facts.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So, but not all of the jurors have to agree with the.
No, I agree with that. I of one
right.
agree with that.
I think the problem. I'm sorry. Are you?
But the point of the matter is, the state has the burden of proving facts that will persuade the jury that one or more of these six offenses took place by the defendant.
That the defendant had that purpose, yes.
That's right. So it seems to me that it's not unreasonable for the defendant to be told in a colloquy what the state has to prove.
I think the problem, in my view, is that when you say to the circuit court, you have to explain the nature of the offense, and that means the elements of the crime, that the circuit court can ascertain, either through unanimity cases or reading the statute or however, what those elements are. When you start talking about these definitions, where do you draw the line? Let's say that the state in this case was alleging a sexual assault or sexual contact under 948.085, which is one of the enumerated sections.
Okay.
Are we going to go through the facility described in section 940.295 sub 2 sub M?
Would it say that if it were giving a jury instruction?
Well, they would have to, most likely,
so it
would have been stipulated to, because there's usually not a dispute about that sort of thing. But
so if they had to say it for a jury instruction,
well, but
it's possible to say it here and do it. I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, it's certainly possible. It was possible for the circuit court to define sexual contact here.
The
problem is that when the circuit court looks at what it has to do, at least in always in the past, we've said you have to describe the elements of the crime, and that's essentially what Steele or Hammer actually.
Right.
Says is because the felony in burglary is not an element, the circuit court didn't have to select which felony it was.
Well, I can't understand why it's not an element for purposes of the plea colloquy and is an element for purpose of a jury instruction.
Well, I think the answer to that question is when you're trying to prove intent, and the sexual assault cases, gypsum in those cases, are dealing with the definition of the prohibited act. The prohibited act here is the luring of the child. So we're talking about the intent, and when you're at a plea colloquy, you're talking to the defendant. We tell juries you can't look into the defendant's mind. Well, the defendant can look into the defendant's mind. So we don't have the same proof problem with intent at a plea colloquy that we do at a trial.
Would it take a lot of time and effort for the trial judge to give the appropriate colloquy?
No, I don't think it. Well, it would depend on which definition you're talking about. Sexual assault or sexual contact, no. If we're talking about the definition contained in 940.25 sub 2 sub M, I'd say, yeah, it would.
So, counsel, I'd like to take a little bit of issue with you in your reference to the crime being the luring the child. That's not entirely true, is it? It's not the luring the child. It's luring the child with an intent to do something else.
Yes, that's correct.
Right? Because luring the child sometimes...
Without the intent would not be the crime.
Not be
criminal.
That's
correct.
Parents lure their children places all the time, right?
Secluded places,
all right.
Yes.
Indeed they are. So what we're looking at, what makes this criminal is that intent.
Right.
All right, so now I want to go through I want to have you help me through this analysis the way I asked Ms. Juris. In the jury context, a jury unanimity context, you'd have to prove, you'd have to get the jury to unanimously agree that he intended to do one of those, something on that list. They don't have to agree on which it is, right?
Right.
But they have to agree that he intended something that was on that list.
Right.
So now, how do we account for that element when we lift it into the plea colloquy context? Why don't we require, as an essential element, that he intend to do a bad thing, and a bad thing is in that list, and therefore he must understand one of those bad things?
I think that this intent and these modes of commission are better dealt with under the factual basis, because there one can explore exactly what the defendant did, and in this case there was the evidence and his agreement that he did what the victim testified to at the preliminary hearing, and both the judge and he can then compare that to what the judge just told him the elements were and say, did you, as the judge did in this case, you lured this child with the intent to have sexual contact. I don't think there was any real question that Mr. Hendricks understood what sexual contact was at that point. I mean, based on his testimony, he kept saying, I hadn't had it, or she said, I hadn't had it, he hadn't had it in a long time. It seems to me it's pretty clear he intended not only sexual contact, which he actually did do, but sexual intercourse. And the state, had it gone to trial, could have submitted both of those to the jury.
Right. So, that's part two of the question here. Did he in fact understand the nature of the crime? Right. But what I want to get to first, though, is, as a legal matter, what is it about child enticement that he has to understand in order to enter a valid plea? And it would seem that if we properly lift the jury unanimity test out of the verdict context and putting it into the plea colloquy context, he would at least have to understand that he had the intent to do a bad thing, something on that list. Wouldn't that be a logical way of looking at this?
Yes, I think it would. And in that aspect, and the only thing where the state is saying here is jury unanimity questions define the elements of the crime. So that's the only thing that goes into the plea colloquy. The court has to instruct the defendant on all of the elements of the crime. So I think the judge did say you had to have the purpose of one of these six intents, although I suspect it was in his explanation of what he had explained with counsel and on the sidebar. But he did come back onto the record, and he did say that to Mr. Hendricks, and then he said, you understand that. You had to lure this child who was under the age of 18 with the purpose of having sexual contact with him.
And that's perhaps an answer to question number two, but question number one would then be, would it be sufficient if the plea colloquy went something like this? The nature of the crime is that you lure a child into one of these situations with the intent to do something bad. Would that be sufficient?
No, but the problem would be that something bad would be perhaps something that wasn't on one of the six.
Okay.
But if the court said instead of something bad, right, one of these six things and so read out the six things, then I think that should be sufficient.
Right. So the court would have to identify one of those alternatives.
One or more.
That would be required by law.
I think so, because the intent is an element. But I don't think the state would have to choose a particular one, and I think the court wouldn't have to go into a detailed definition of what the purposes of each of those are if there was, for instance, sexual contact.
You might lose me on the analysis here, and I don't want you to do that.
Right.
So if the in accepting the plea, the court has to identify one of them, or the parties have to identify one of them.
At least one of them.
At least one of them, right? And if that's required, that they identify at least one of them, does it not necessarily follow that the defendant would have to understand it?
I don't think so, and I don't think so because we're not talking about whether a particular act constitutes the element. We're talking about what's in the defendant's mind, and the defendant is actually the best person to be able to tell that.
Well, that's true, but it's not just a free-floating, unconnected-to-anything intent. It's an intent to do something, right? And it's the something that makes what he did criminal. And so why would it not be necessary? Because let me put it this way. If he doesn't need to understand the bad thing that he intended to do, then we would be accepting a plea in which the only thing he understood he did was completely lawful.
I don't.
Because luring a child is not a crime. So he understands that.
Right.
And we say, you don't need to understand the intent to do a bad thing. You don't need to understand that. And he says, okay, I don't understand that. I enter my plea. The court accepts the plea. The court's accepted a plea based on him understanding that he did something completely lawful.
But I guess where I have trouble with that is saying you did this with the purpose of having sexual contact. In the context of this case, I think Mr. Hendricks did understand what that meant.
Now, that's a separate question, though, right?
Well, I don't know you can separate them.
This is the way you separate it. Let's say that he, in fact, did understand it. That doesn't answer the question of whether it's required that he understand that, right? I mean, we're trying to get to a rule here, and we're trying to figure out what he's required to understand. Because whatever we write here is not going to be applicable just to Mr. Hendricks. It's going to be instruction for further cases. And the circuit courts need to know what is it that the defendant needs to understand. So as they're looking at a case, they're accepting a plea, and they're in the same position as Mr. Hendricks, they're going to ask, does this defendant need to understand what sexual contact is?
Well, I think what he really needs to understand is whether what he actually did and the purpose he actually had did fulfill the elements of the crime. Because that's really what a knowing and intelligent plea means. And that's why it seems to me we focus too much on encapsulating these various requirements. Really, they're all one, and especially the elements of the crime and the factual basis, but they overlap so much it's very difficult, I think, to separate them out. In some of the cases, even, you can't tell whether or not the court's talking about factual basis or the elements of the crime. And ultimately, what we need to have is that the court's satisfied that the acts to which this defendant admits constituted the crime and the defendant understood that these acts constituted the crime.
Right. And I think that's an analysis that has to be done. But let's strip away some of the evidence that was in this case. Let's say the victim didn't testify. Let's say the complaint didn't say all that it said about the sexual contact that just occurred. So let's say instead that the prosecution describes the act of luring and says with the intent to have sexual contact. And there's no evidence describing what that contact was. There's no colloquy with respect to his understanding of what sexual contact is. Is that sufficient?
For the whole plea, it wouldn't be because it wouldn't set forth a factual basis. But I think it would if the court actually referred to one or more of the listed intents, it would meet the nature of the offense.
So the court says it's enticement for the purpose of having a sexual contact.
Right.
Right. Does the court have to have any discussion at all about what sexual contact means?
If you want to encapsulate it for the elements of the crime and the factual basis, I would say no. But if it doesn't go through whether or not these particular acts meet the definition of sexual contact, then it hasn't determined that there's a factual basis for the... And this is the kind of overlap, it seems to me, that causes a lot of the problem when we get into this rather technical analysis of the plea colloquies, which is, frankly, one of the problems that I think Bangert creates. And I suspect some or all of that is unavoidable, yeah. But it seems to me that we get focused on the technicality of the elements of the crime or understanding the elements of the crime or what's the factual basis without looking at a broader picture of whether or not altogether the plea is knowing and intelligent.
So are you suggesting perhaps that we're asking how many angels dance on the head of a pin when we inquire into whether he was informed of the nature of the crime, the essential elements, versus the facts that satisfy those elements?
Again, it seems to me that the overlap is what causes the problem. And when you look at the way the Supreme Court has expressed the constitutional requirement, it says the nature of the crime in relation to the facts, which to me says it's really kind of a false dichotomy to be able to say we can put the elements of the crime and the factual basis on two entirely separate pedestals. I don't think we can. It's just too much of an overlap. And certainly when you ask the circuit court to go through a plea colloquy, I think you have to say to the circuit court, you have to list all of the elements of the crime. But when you get into these definitions, and this I think the same is true for party to the crime kinds of inquiries, it's really the focus on the facts of the particular case that inform whether or not what the defendant did in this case constitutes all of the elements of the crime or whether or not it makes the person a party to the crime, because it does turn more on the facts than it does on the elements.
So if there had not been the introduction of facts that supported that he had the intent to have sexual contact, then that would have been a defective plea colloquy.
Yes, I think so. I think that one of the problems that we have is in the Bangert setup, we never really require a defendant to testify. They allege something in a motion, and if, for instance, we go through the technicality and we say, oh, the court should have done this and didn't, we immediately go to the state having to produce the evidence. We never have the defendant testify, I didn't understand that, and we never have a determination by the circuit court about whether or not that's credible.
Well, the defendant,
but that's not in this
the
case.
Defendant has to aver that.
Yes,
yeah,
right. You have to
I
aver
want to
that.
Get to your mushing, in my mind, two separate concepts together. And this is an extension of my former questioning here. And we often focus on the cases, right? We've got, of course, not only Bangert here and Brown here. We have Hendricks to talk about, Bolig to talk about, and other cases. But I want to take a look at the statute. And the statute, 97108, doesn't mush them together. It has these as separate inquiries. 97108 before the court accepts a plea of guilty of no or no contest, it shall do all of the following. It shall address the defendant personally and determine that the plea is made voluntarily with understanding of the nature of the charge and the potential penalties associated therewith. The second is must make such inquiry as satisfies if the defendant in fact committed the crime charged. So you indicated in response to a question advanced by Justice Kelly that you're just not sure that these are should be constitutionally in two different tiers, these inquiries, but statutorily they also are. Is 971-08 infirm in setting them on two separate tiers?
Well, it lists them separately, certainly, but I'm not sure that means the inquiry has to be separate.
Well, I don't know. It says must do all of the following.
Right.
Then it says A, which
I read. Doesn't say all separately.
No, you're right. The words all separately do not appear. But it lists them discreetly. At least would you give me that?
It does list them discreetly, okay. Yes. I would just like to say one thing about asking the court to pare back what the counsel has to say on the record. The later developed constitutional case law indicates that an explicit recitation by counsel is sufficient.
Well, but counsel said, didn't he or she, that an explanation of the elements was made.
Right.
But you're arguing that the intent was not an element. Therefore, I don't see that counsel agreed.
He said we've gone over the elements of the offense.
That's right. But you're telling me, or us, that the intent part, numbers 1 through 6, are not elements.
That's
so correct. When he says he went through the elements, I'm not sure that he said that she was lured away with the intent to commit sexual contact.
Well,
because that's not an element. So it doesn't quite hang together for me.
Well, but it doesn't remove that as a claim. It just moves it from a Bangert claim to a Nelson Bentley claim. I mean, a defendant can still say, oh, my attorney explanation didn't make clear to me that sexual contact had to be for sexual gratification.
Okay.
And that allegation, and we have a hearing on it the way we do any other Nelson Bentley plea withdrawal, and we can make a determination about that. But it seems to me that once we get into if the attorney says to the court, I went over all the elements, I explained how this works, the court should be able to accept that. If the defendant then disagrees, then he files a Nelson Bentley motion.
Well, you want on page 23 to adopt the U.S. Supreme Court rule from Stempf that an express representation on the record by competent counsel is sufficient. But that isn't the facts of this case.
Well, I think it is. I think it is because he said he went over the essential element. Again, we get back to what is the nature of the offense.
That's right.
The nature of the offense is the elements, then what he said does clearly satisfy Bradshaw. But if it's not, then I don't know that we even get to that point.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. The state explained it, I think, well when they said he needed to know what it is he needs to know what he did and whether it fits. The way a defendant knows whether or not it fits is by the way we ensure that is by making sure that a defendant had an accurate knowledge of those legal standards. And I think to come back to the question Your Honor, Chief Justice asked me about the factual basis and making sure that the factual basis he agrees to, and if that's enough, shouldn't that be sufficient? The reason why I said to hold that that alone is sufficient under bank, or the reason why I said that to hold that that alone would undercut Bangert is because when a defendant pleads guilty, there will always be facts in the record that support that guilt. If there's not, we have a significant and separate problem that is the factual basis problem. And so if all that we're requiring is that a court, a defendant agrees, yes, I did these facts, and the court then assures itself that those facts amount to the factual basis, none of what's required under Bangert would be necessary because the court has to go that step further to make sure that a defendant knows so he can judge that standard. And I think to come back to the question Your Honor, Justice Kelly asked me about would it have been enough for the court here to simply say, okay, and I'm telling you that what you did here was sexual contact? I think a different hypothetical would be helpful. So let's say that there is a defendant who's charged with sexual contact where he's at a party with family and friends and it's an adult man and they're in a pool and they're playing the game chicken, right? So that he's got a teenage girl sitting on his shoulders and they're playing in the pool. And he's charged with he's charged with touching her rear end, let's say. In that situation, if the defendant says, yes, I agree to the facts in the complaint, and the court says, okay, and I'm telling you that sexual contact, we still don't know from that record whether the defendant was aware that that required that he intentionally did the touching and that the touching was for the purpose of either his sexual gratification or her humiliation.
But in this case, we do know that that's what it was for, right?
Well, we know that the facts...
Mr. Hendricks knows, too. He heard the victim testify, and he said, that's the contact I agree occurred, and that's the contact that supports the plea. That's what he said.
He did, but that doesn't tell us that he knew that this was... It had to be intentional touching for either his... sexual gratification or her humiliation. He could, under this record, have a completely incorrect understanding of what sexual contact means.
But he knows that he was touching her for the purpose of his sexual gratification, right? The record tells us that.
He knows that he was touching her. He knows that she said that he made comments that would suggest it's for his gratification.
And he admitted to that.
And he admitted to that, but that doesn't establish that he understood what it was that the state would have to prove if this charge were to go to trial. And this court explained in Bangert, it repeated it in Brown, it's repeated it since, that we can't infer a defendant's understanding from the record. We can't infer his knowledge of the legal requirements of that from the record. The state notes that at a Bangert hearing, or that perhaps one of the problems with Bangert is that we don't have the defendant's testimony. At the evidentiary hearing, the state is absolutely free to call the defendant to testify. That's why we have these evidentiary hearings, for the state to prove, whether it's through the defendant's testimony, other portions of the record, or both, that the defendant did in fact have this understanding. All we're asking is to have that evidentiary hearing so we can know, instead of inferring or guessing, that whether Mr. Hendricks did have that understanding. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you both for good and spirited arguments, as usual. I always enjoy our arguments. We are now going to adjourn. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:05.